Today is Friday, September 4th. This is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, Joe Biden visits Kenosha, Wisconsin, the latest city to be at the forefront of racial tensions.
I think there is a chance for a real awakening here. And the point is, I don't think we have any alternative but to fight.
Russia denies involvement in poisoning Vladimir Putin's strongest critic, but there seems to be a pattern with the Kremlin.
We've seen time and time again opponents of Russian government, for whatever reason, fall ill or murdered or poisoned.
Also ahead, the rising stardom of two Malawian street musicians. It's all on today's International Edition. Democratic presidential nominee Joe Biden and his wife Jill traveled to Kenosha, Wisconsin on Thursday, the latest city to be the subject of racial tensions following the police shooting of a black man. AP correspondent Sagar Magani reports.
In Kenosha, Wisconsin, which is still reeling after protests over Jacob Blake's shooting, Biden said the country is finally getting ready for change.
This is not who we are.
Biden says he spoke on the phone with Blake, who is hospitalized, and met with his family, later telling a community meeting he wants to find common ground, contrasting his visit with that of President Trump, who was in Kenosha 2 days ago and did not mention Blake. Biden heard from activist Portia Bennett, who says black people have been shown for years they just don't matter.
I see it, I live it.
Biden says he'll fight for change.
There's certain things worth losing over. And this is something worth losing over. We have to, but we're not going to lose.
Sagar Magani, Washington.
President Trump visited Kenosha earlier in the week, where he met with local police officials and focused on protests and property destruction while continuing his campaign message of law and order. Joining us to talk about the president's strategy is Jennifer Victor, Associate Professor of Political Science at the Schar School of Policy and Government at George Mason University in Virginia. Thank you for being with us. So it is interesting how dramatically different the two campaign strategies are.
The strategies followed by the Trump campaign are pretty interesting in a lot of ways. As you note, he is the incumbent candidate, but he's also the trailing candidate. So he's been behind in the polls. His approval numbers are around 42-43% or so, which is low for an incumbent seeking re-election. We've never re-elected an incumbent at that level. The economy is not doing well. We've got, 10% unemployment and so forth related to the pandemic. And so how an incumbent president handles those challenges and how the campaign basically tries to spin a re-elect me campaign strategy out of those circumstances is pretty fascinating. And so to me, I think of it as the Trump campaign is following everything that they're putting out there falls into one of three buckets. I'm thinking of them as deny, deflect, and distract. So on the deny, like when the Trump administration is accused of negligence with respect to the coronavirus or anything else that comes their way, there's a fair amount of just denial. It's not as bad as you think it is. I feel like you see the denial strategy almost more from Republican surrogates than you do from the White House or the Trump campaign directly. It's very heavily in the category of misinformation that's out there about the death rates of coronavirus or other things, other misinformation that gets spread about the pandemic. The second D that I've got is deflect, which is we're seeing a lot from the Trump campaign these days, which is they don't want to take the blame for the economy or the pandemic or anything else that might be seen as negative. And so they are painting Democrats as being at fault for that. So earlier you saw President Trump tweeting at Andrew Cuomo, governor of New York, saying that it was, his bad leadership in New York that led to 11,000 COVID deaths there, which might seem kind of rich coming from a president who's in charge of a nation that has more than 10 times that in the nation. But the story that they're trying to tell is that it's not a national problem, but it's a local problem. And places where you have local spikes in the virus or local racial unrest, it works for that issue as well, that it's not the administration's fault, but it's the fault of local Democrat governors and mayors. So trying to deflect the blame onto his opposing party. And then the third D is distract. So we also see the Trump campaign doing a fair amount of distractions. You know, the constant tweeting, the constant sort of crisis to crisis exhaustion is a strategy. It's part of the strategy that exhausts people of the politics. It exhausts people of the outrage. It's hard to get outraged and sustain your outrage at any one crisis or a scandal that pops up when there's a seemingly bigger one just, you know, the next hour or the next day. That's sort of a distraction strategy that I think we see the Trump campaign in particular using this time.
Interesting, though, the president and the campaign don't seem to be changing any of their strategy, despite the fact that they're not gaining in the polls and they don't seem to have gotten any sort of slight bump after the Republican National Convention.
Yeah, this is one of the most remarkable things, I think, about the Trump presidency, because his approval ratings across the whole course of his presidency are just remarkably flat. It just seems like whether good things or bad things are happening, his approval ratings just don't move. We haven't seen stability across time in a president's approval ratings anywhere like we've seen with Donald Trump. It's really almost unbelievable. The best I can do, I think, for offering somewhat of an explanation for this is part of it is just polarization, right? So as you have increasing partisan polarization, so as both parties get more extreme and as the distance between both parties grows, in both parties, you get the sense that the other party is dangerous. And then if you lose to the other party, it's going to be the downfall of the country or the society or whatnot. And so that increase of threat and fear from the out party increases that sense that things are really dire. And so as polarization worsens, people who are already aligned with the president will have a tendency to incorporate any information that might contradict their positive view of the president and, using a sort of a psychological motivated reasoning, figure out how to not let that harm their viewpoint on the president and rather figure out a way to rationalize it into their worldview. And then there is also a little bit of, I think, also a media effect going on that is also related to polarization, as the data show that liberals tend to have more variety in their news consumption diet. So they listen to and read and watch more sources, whereas conservatives really are pretty well fixed on Fox News as a source of information and conservative talk radio. Mm-hmm. And the lack of variance in the news that comes to conservatives, I think, also contributes to sort of a media bubble that prevents Democrats and conservatives from sharing a worldview and sharing a set of facts.
Jennifer Victor, Associate Professor of Political Science at the Schar School of Policy and Government at George Mason University. Russia said Thursday the West should not rush to judge it over the poisoning of Kremlin critic Alexei Navalny and said there were no grounds to accuse it of the crime. Moscow was speaking a day after German Chancellor Angela Merkel said Navalny had been poisoned with a Soviet-style Novichok nerve agent in an attempt to murder him and that she would consult NATO allies about how to respond. Joining us now is reporter Charles Maines in Moscow. Thanks for being with us. So tell us more about the Kremlin's response on Thursday.
Well, first of all, they've cast doubt on Angela Merkel's first conclusion, which is that this, because it's Novichok, what the German specialist found within Mr. Navalny doing his analyses, that this had to be from a state actor. This is a Soviet-produced nerve agent, which suggests that there was a state actor involved. And so Russia has said, look, we first of all don't agree with these analyses. We haven't seen the report yet. We haven't gotten any information from the Germans. And Russia, nonetheless, is just has played no role in this. There's nothing really to respond to at this point. And what's interesting is that, you know, we seem to be headed for kind of a repeat of what we saw in Salisbury in England, in the UK. Back in 2018, there was a former Russian spy, Sergei Skripal, and his daughter Yulia were poisoned with what British authorities said was Novichok. And the Russians always came out and said, like, look, this wasn't us. And also they mock this idea of what the British called highly likely, this idea that it was very likely that it was Novichok and very likely that it was a Soviet-Russian-produced nerve agent. Here now the Germans have been much more specific, saying this is definite. But still, we've seen this kind of same line playing out, and it suggests that you're going to see again this kind of east-west split over the issue.
Is Russia even willing to conduct an investigation? Is it even taking any interest at all in getting to the bottom of it? Or is it like you sort of have alluded to here, that it's just basically sort of going to sweep it under the rug?
Right. I mean, there's sort of these kind of dual realities playing out before our eyes, right? And certainly with what's been interesting so far is that even after Mr. Navalny fell ill on August 20th, while he was flying back from Siberia to Moscow, he'd been on some campaign stops to work for his political purposes. And, you know, right away, the Russians were saying, look, there's no reason to hold an investigation because there's no proof of poisoning. The Russian doctors in Siberia, where he was treated, said they could find no proof of any poisoning. And so they stuck with this line. In fact, We heard on Thursday from Mr. Putin's spokesman, Dmitry Peskov, who said that essentially when the Russians had agreed to release Mr. Navalny, the Russian doctors agreed to release Mr. Navalny to Berlin for treatment, that at that point they found no indication of any poisons or any Novichok in his system. So that seems to be their main story. Now, it's also interesting that the Russian government has said until there was proof of any poisoning, they weren't going to hold any investigation, although they say they're interested in hearing from the German government about what they found. On sort of a side track, we've also heard from the lower house of parliament, which is holding its own investigation, even though the Russian government said there was nothing to investigate, saying that what they're concerned about is that this was Western security services poisoning Mr. Navalny on purpose to blacken Russia's image and perhaps nullify some commercial deals, in particular with Germany. It's a gas pipeline, which has been a big issue there.
Right. Now, I know that European Union leaders and NATO leaders are all taking a good hard look at this before they make any decisions about a response. And of course, they want to make sure they have all their information and that it's all factual. But there does seem to be a historic pattern with Russia and people who go against the government, is there not?
There is. It's a pretty grim tradition, I must say. You know, we've seen time and time again opponents of the Russian government, for whatever reason, fall ill or murdered are poisoned. Some survive, some don't. And this seems to be in that pattern. And one of the arguments always in Russia is sort of in defense of Vladimir Putin, in defense of the Russian president, is that it's not in his interest. You know, why would he want an opposition figure of the status of Mr. Navalny dead? On the one hand, he's an opponent, yes, but of course it gets a lot of grief thrown his way as well. And so it sort of posits out two options, which people seem to come to, which is that one, that Mr. Putin is in some form okaying some of these actions, or else so it goes against this idea that Mr. Putin is so in charge of the Russian system as likes to be sort of portrayed. In fact, there are a lot of freelance actors in security services and other aspects of society that are making these moves in theory on his behalf, or maybe even to please the Russian president. But it's sort of the eternal mystery and the big question, of course, surrounding all these issues. But I would add that Mr. Navalny's associates say that the fact that it was Novichok, the fact that it was a Soviet-produced toxin that's in control of the government in small supplies, it's outlawed, but we know that they had it, you know, that suggests that this does involve kind of state actors. And that was Angela Merkel's point to begin with.
That Vladimir Putin would have had to have authorized it? Is that what you mean?
Well, it's either Vladimir Putin or someone within the Russian government, but you just can't say that this is some kind of freelance, you know. I mean, Mr. Navalny is, with his anti-corruption work, has created a long list of enemies, of powerful enemies, both in the government and the business community here. And the suggestion being that somehow, you know, his bill came due in some way that people came after him. The fact that it's something within state apparatus, this nerve agent, suggests that somehow, whether Mr. Putin approved it or not, that it's somehow state involved.
That was reporter Charles Maines in Moscow. Angry Ethiopian officials demanded an explanation from the U.S. after it announced this week it would cut millions in aid over the country's decision to begin filling a massive hydropower dam on the Nile River, which Egypt has opposed. Simon Marks reports from Addis Ababa.
The U.S. State Department on Wednesday announced it would place a temporary pause on tens of millions of dollars in foreign assistance to Ethiopia in response to authorities there filling a reservoir at the Grand Ethiopian Renaissance Dam. Egypt, Ethiopia and Sudan have been locked in a bitter dispute over the GERD and the waters of the Nile for nearly a decade. The U.S. entered the fray last year and attempted to broker an agreement, only for Ethiopia to step away from those talks due to suspicions over a bias in Washington towards Egypt. Eyob Tekelin, Ethiopia's state finance minister, told VOA that the government has requested the U.S. provide a full explanation for the aid cut. He also said he believed the situation can be resolved quickly.
We don't think the U.S. has thought this through carefully, because the partnership between the U.S. and Ethiopia is solid, very strong, and continues to be. So we consider this some misunderstanding. We don't think this will last. We are very hopeful that they would reconsider, because Ethiopia is doing what is absolutely right in all sense of the word, legally, morally as well.
In Washington, talks over whether to cut aid to Ethiopia have been going on for weeks. While some State Department officials opposed the move due to the possible diplomatic fallout, others close to the White House and President Donald Trump pushed to make an example of Ethiopia for starting to fill the reservoir without first getting an agreement with Egypt and Sudan. A State Department official told VOA in a statement that the decision to pause assistance for Ethiopia reflects concerns about Ethiopia's unilateral decision to fill the dam before an agreement and all necessary dam safety measures were in place. The official also stipulated the decision was based on guidance from the president and that cuts would not be made to programs tackling HIV/AIDS, conflict, drought, displacement, and other humanitarian challenges. The cuts will impact programs linked to regional security and could amount to roughly $100 million. Rashid Abdi, a senior analyst on Horn of Africa politics, told VOA that the aid suspension may also be tied to Ethiopia's recent crackdown on opposition leaders and supporters following protests that erupted after the death of the popular Oromo singer Hachilu Hundessa.
There is a growing, I think, discontent with Abiy's leadership style, but also the country's authoritarian drift. So this could be a signal to put basically Abiy on notice and to tell him that, look, our strategic relationship could be damaged if you continue down this path.
The next round of discussions between Egypt, Ethiopia and Sudan is scheduled for September 14. Simon Marks for VOA News, Addis Ababa.
The State Department Thursday did respond in a statement saying Ethiopia's unilateral decision to fill the Grand Ethiopian Renaissance Dam without an agreement with Egypt and Sudan. The Secretary of State, based on guidance from the president, has decided to put a temporary pause on certain U.S. foreign assistance for Ethiopia. It also said U.S.-Ethiopian relations are based on shared priorities in promoting peace and security in the Horn of Africa and strong support for the historic political and economic reforms undertaken by the current Ethiopian government. The United States on Wednesday announced sanctions against the prosecutor of the International Criminal Court, Fatou Bensouda. The 59-year-old Bensouda, a Gambian national, had angered the Trump administration by opening an investigation into crimes allegedly committed by American soldiers in Afghanistan. For reaction, VOA's Jason Patinkin spoke to Simon Adams, executive director of the Global Center for the Responsibility to Protect.
I mean, I think it's terrible. I think there's a lot at stake. And I think what's most at stake is the idea that all war crimes are equally abhorrent and illegal, regardless of the nationality of the perpetrator. It's very sad that this is coming from the United States because, you know, from Nuremberg to the founding of the ICC, the U.S. has played a key, you know, if inconsistent role in promoting the idea of international justice. And now it's kind of made itself an enemy of the International Criminal Court.
Now, does the ICC have the legal jurisdiction to investigate the U.S. in Afghanistan?
It does. So it's authorized to investigate what has happened in Afghanistan. And the approach of the court has been, okay, we need to look at all potential atrocities that have been committed in Afghanistan, regardless of the nationality of the perpetrator. That means crimes committed by the Taliban, most obviously, but also by the Afghan government and also by U.S. troops at black sites. The accusations are mainly around torture. The thing is here, if the U.S. wanted to avoid any kind of international scrutiny around this, if it wanted to kind of rebuff the International Criminal Court, the best way of doing so is to make sure that it holds any war criminals accountable in a domestic court. Instead, we have a situation where the president of the United States appears to be willing to pardon and give them a public platform.
There's been a lot of pushback against this. Why do you think there's been such a response to these sanctions?
Because I think people realize, you know, what's going on. This is a retreat into the idea that, you know, war crimes are only war crimes when they're committed by other people. It's a rejection of the ICC, which was, of course, created to prosecute perpetrators of war crimes, genocide, and crimes against humanity, the most serious crimes that can be perpetrated. And so, you know, I think the reaction that we're seeing is in part because people understand that after yesterday's announcement, those who are responsible for war crimes in Syria or for genocide in Myanmar and for other atrocities in other conflict zones in different parts of the world, including on the African continent, all those perpetrators went to bed last night and slept a little more soundly, knowing that the U.S. attack on the ICC helps their attempt to evade justice as well.
Now, do you think these sanctions will have an actual impact on the ICC's ability to do its job?
I think it's more about intimidation than about affecting the operational effectiveness of the court. So even back in June when Trump issued his executive order, I think there were already, for example, U.S.-based foundations who fund human rights organizations and support human rights work in different parts of the world, who were reaching out to those organizations and saying, hey, what's your relationship with the ICC? Because, you know, we don't want to be in some kind of conflictual relationship, funding relationship that could get us into trouble if there are any U.S. sanctions. So I think the net effect is the one, which is precisely the one that the U.S. government is intended in this situation, which is to intimidate and is to create a climate of fear which discourages people from cooperating with the International Criminal Court.
Simon Adams, executive director of the Global Center for the Responsibility to Protect in New York, speaking with VOA's Jason Patinkin. Lebanon's army said Thursday it had found 4.35 tons of ammonium nitrate near the entrance to Beirut port, the site of a huge blast last month caused by a large stockpile of the same highly explosive chemical. Army engineers were, quote, dealing with it, according to an army statement carried by the state news agency. Belarusian leader Alexander Lukashenko promoted hardline loyalists to top posts in his security apparatus Thursday, in an effort to strengthen his grip on the former Soviet Republic after weeks of mass protests and strikes. Lukashenko, facing the biggest challenge to his 26-year rule, accompanied the reshuffle with instructions to act tough in the face of what he has repeatedly alleged is foreign aggression. You're listening to International Edition. Back in a minute.
This is Heather Maxwell, host of Music Time in Africa. Join me every Saturday and Sunday for an hour of awesome African music. Wake up, dance this music. Like to stay on top of new music trends, breakout artists, new releases? Maybe you just love the classic styles and the artists of the past. Or simply the sound and feel of a good beat. Whatever your pleasure, you can get it every week right here on Music Time in Africa. So join me on your local FM station, Saturdays and Sundays at 1500 and 2000 UTC.
VOA's International Edition continues. NASA this week moved closer to its next crewed mission to the moon. And a successful rocket test means they know how to get there, while scientists in India have developed eco-friendly bricks for building structures on the lunar surface. VOA's Arash Arabasadi has the week in space.
2-1, fire.
This week at a facility in Utah, NASA successfully tested its Space Launch System, or SLS, full-scale solid rocket booster. NASA Administrator Jim Bridenstine explains the test's value in the next mission to the moon.
Now we're building the most powerful rocket in the history of humanity that will take not just the next man, but the first woman to the moon by 2024 in the Artemis program. This program is commercial in nature, but it's also international in nature.
The nearly 47-meter motor fired just over 2 minutes, producing 16 million newtons of thrust. The successful test moves ahead plans for an uncrewed launch next year, followed by a crewed mission in 2023. NASA's Artemis program is named after the Greek goddess of the moon, Apollo's sister. Elsewhere, researchers from India's Space Agency and the Indian Institute of Science say they have built eco-friendly space bricks. Assistant Professor Aloki Kumar says the building materials were developed to offer space agencies a way to build housing during interplanetary missions.
They want to send astronauts for longer and longer missions, and where they want the astronauts to stay for very long durations and be able to conduct various experiments or maybe even do space mining on the moon and Mars.
Scientists developed a sustainable process combining lunar soil simulant, bacteria, and beans to make a load-bearing structure. Creating building materials on site could save space programs a fortune, with it costing about $10,000 to send roughly half a kilogram of material to space. Separately, astronomers last week expressed concern about the glare from satellites like those in SpaceX's Starlink network shown in this YouTube video posted by astronomer Cece Bassa. SpaceX says Starlink will bring internet to underserved parts of the world, while scientists say the brightness of those satellites will end space research from telescopes on Earth. SpaceX has since launched another 60 satellites into orbit. Arash Arabasadi, VOA News, Washington.
In recent years, two street musicians from Malawi, Yobu Maligwa and Yosef Kalakene, have risen up from busking in Lilongwe to crushing show-stopping performances on some of the world's biggest music festivals. Earlier this week, VOA's Heather Maxwell joined up virtually with the guys and their manager, Neil Nayar, in Lilongwe to learn more about their story and their newest song, a collaboration with a Ukrainian trio.
How did you meet Tiktu?
We just got a Facebook from a guy called Lesik in Ukraine. He said, it was a nice email. We love your music of Madalitsa. I play you when I go and DJ. It's lockdown, it's crazy. What about if we do an online collaboration? We'd never been to Ukraine, we've never played in Ukraine, but somehow he'd heard of the band and that was it.
How long have you guys been playing together and how did you first start?
2001.
Just like a random meeting in Area 49 of Lilongwe in 2001, when Yosef was walking with a guitar and they started chatting on the street and they just got on with each other and said, hey, how about we start making some music together? That was it, a random meeting on the streets.
And so when did their career start really picking up? Because now, look, I mean, they're getting people, musicians from all over the world, from, you know, noticing them on Facebook and reaching out and saying, you know, asking to do collaborations. So how did they get from busking in the streets of Lilongwe to being noticed by other musicians worldwide asking to do collaborations with them?
Well, one simple festival in Zanzibar, but happened to be Sauti za Busara.
Not such a simple festival.
Yeah, there was a booker for Roskilde Festival in the audience. There was BBC in the audience. There was a record label in Switzerland in the audience. And these guys was their first time to play outside Malawi, but all of a sudden people just came and asked us, like, hey, have these guys been in Europe? How, you know, we'd like to book them. And then it just started like that. And then their first tour was 2 weeks, the next one was 5 weeks, then 9 weeks. So they just had such a great impact. Then it sort of started picking up like that.
What culture are you representing exactly? I mean, Malawi, of course, but is there something more specific? Because we should mention that cool instrument that most people have never seen, I don't think, the babaton. So how are these things related? What culture are you representing?
Is it just for Malawi?
Yeah.
Or Kapena, like, you say, like more specific, like Ngoni, Kapena, Chichewa, Kapena?
I think Ngoni, Chichewa, Ngoni, Achewa.
Because they're two different tribal backgrounds, Ngoni and Chewa. And so it's a representation of that kind of vibe, I suppose, particularly from the central region of Malawi.
And Yosefe, I noticed that your drum is basically your foot kicking against the side of a drum. So you're playing the drum basically with your foot, right? I like that.
All of Malawi, I've never seen anybody else play the drum like that, right?
Modalitsu Band and Neil Nayar, they're in Lilongwe, Malawi. Thank you so much for joining me and I wish you the best of luck. I love your music.
Thank you.
Thank you. Come on. Thank you. Thank you for having us.
You've been listening to International Edition. That's it for our show today, but you can always find us at voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Jackson Vunganyi, I'm Lori London in Washington. Thanks so much for being with us, and have a great weekend.